This morning, it's my pleasure to be speaking to Zain Abubakar, Executive Director of the Muslims for Human Rights, headquartered in Mombasa. Zain is not somebody who is unknown to East Africans. He is a former member of the East African Parliament, and while he was there, was chairman of the Regional Affairs and Conflict Resolution Committee of that parliament. Zain was also a member of the Constitution of Kenya Review Commission that developed the constitution that was promulgated in 2010. Zain is also a thespian and a founding director of the Oracha Collective. And he's also a strategist, historian. Shukran, Zain, for joining the elephant for this conversation this morning.
Thank you very much, John. It's my pleasure to appear in this important program and conversation.
Asante, Zain. As you know, we've been doing a series of conversations that focus on the coronavirus, COVID-19 impact on our lives. From a Kenyan perspective, but we also now started reaching further, you know, further afield and talking to some of our friends in Asia, in America, and also getting a sense of how it's impacting them, because it's clear that this is in very, you know, very many ways a disruption of global proportions. People will speak of there was a time before COVID-19. In the future, they will speak of the time after COVID-19. That is the sheer scale of it, economically, politically, and socially. I was struck, you know, in our prior conversation, Zain, which is the reason, given you just the sheer breadth of your experience of some of the ways in which you analyze this issue. And what's interesting is that people have very quickly moved on from discussing the virus itself to realizing and appreciating that the impact of the responses that have been put in place is far more severe than the virus itself. And perhaps I can start with that question. Discussed with you, you said there are different theories informing responses, and perhaps you can reflect a bit on that, and we can start our conversation with that, because the different responses are eliciting different consequences, and it's clear now that these consequences will not just last a few months, but may last many years, if not a generation.
Thank you very much, John. Generally speaking, there are two main responses, or if you like, values and philosophies that inform responses in the world. And I'm generalizing for the purpose of having this conversation. Globally, you will see most of the countries have adopted what we call a security state approach. The security state approach basically is informed by the Westphalian conceptualization of what a state is, and then the use of state instruments in order to implement state policy. This approach is mainly informed by the need to protect state structures and the need to protect the state and its existence. And in ordinary parlance, then you would say that in the classical definition of what a state is, you say that there is a central authority, and then this central authority exercises control over a given geographical jurisdiction, and also they have monopoly of violence over that geographical area. Now, if you start with the question of central authority, then you will see that the response has had people making decisions for countries in a centralized fashion. Mm. So it's a small group of people meeting under security structures. Yes. So if you look at most of their organizing structures, they'll tell you it is the National Security Committee, or it's a National Security Response Committee. They will always underline the question of security.
Good.
Yeah. And then they will make decisions on behalf of the whole country and then implement them. And in the implementation, they will then exercise their authority over this jurisdiction. And in many cases, they will use violence, yeah, or the tools of violence. Yeah. In other words, they give instructions, and people are supposed to obey or comply with those instructions. Yes. Now, this security mentality and approach also uses a specific language, a specific idiom. And this language would be use of military concepts and use of war-like adjectives. So they will be talking about fighting a war. Mm. To them, it's a war. They say, we fight this war. We must wage war. we must eliminate the virus.
Yes.
But you see, these structures are not very well equipped with dealing with a threat such as coronavirus. They are designed to deal with traditional enemies. In other words, other human beings carrying weapons and threatening the state and the state response to them. Coronavirus has a very distinct nature, which requires behavior change. Now, behavior change cannot be coerced. We have seen this in the past in many, many cases. You can't coerce behavior change. Behavior change is part and parcel of the worldview of an individual or a group of people, and it is reinforced by their cosmological understanding of who they are, where are they coming from, where are they going. We have had this situation complicating our lives responding to other diseases in the past. So, for example, if you're to make comparisons, you could not use, in the initial stages of the HIV/AIDS, they tried using the security approach and it did not work either, because HIV/AIDS could only be managed largely after three things happened. One, there was a lot of knowledge or a lot of education that was extended. Two, that people were reached at the level of behavior change. And then three, there was development of medications that were able to prolong people's lives and make people live normal lives. So the challenge we face now is to create behavior change in a very short period of time. And coercive measures to get compliance or to get obedience by citizens will only give you so much. First of all, our security infrastructure is not extended enough for us to carry out that function in that way. But there is another approach which other people have either adopted wholly or have adopted components of it or have blended between the security approach together with what we call a human rights approach, a humanitarian approach, a restorative justice approach. Now, what is the difference between this approach and the security approach? The restorative justice approach focuses on the dignity of the people, the dignity of the individual, the well-being of the people. See, the other one is looking at the well-being of the state. The other one is looking at the security of the state. This right. other one is looking for the security of the person and the human being. So you could even say it's a human security approach. This approach focuses on values. It focuses on responding based on those values. So it seeks to leverage human experience, human dignity, human rights, and it is a consultative process. It values the participation of the people, and it sees the solution to a challenge posed by a pandemic such as this COVID-19 as the response will come based on the people's response. And that if you can then work with the people to find solutions that they themselves participate in making, then it is much easier. It is much easier to implement this than if you were to use coercive methods. I'll give you two examples. There are countries that do not have either political instruments or legislative instruments that they can use to enforce a security approach and coerce people to stay at home as a measure of countering the coronavirus. Such countries like Japan, other countries like Norway, Sweden, and so on. But there are other countries that they can use this, like China, like Rwanda, like other countries that can use the state machinery that they can lock down. Now, you'll see that the effectiveness are different. A society that is democratic, that is open, that is not controlled, that does not have high technology to monitor facial recognition of people, cannot use a security approach in solving this. And ideally, we who believe in human life and value human life and human dignity, we should be saying, let us use the human rights approach, which is less forceful, less coercive, less intrusive, but it is dependent on somebody willing and able to do the right thing. So let me finish with 3 points. One, in order to have behavior change, you need the following, which is a sum total of information, that somebody has the right information, they have knowledge. In other words, they can apply that information. The element of application is internalized, so they have knowledge. They also have skills, right? Now, if you start from information, you're told, okay, you in certain circumstances, you know, not all the time. All the time is not good to wear a mask.
Yes.
But in a certain situation, for example, you are coming close to an infected person, it might be useful for that person to wear a mask and for you to wear a mask. You need information. That is information. Knowledge, you know how to access a mask, and then skill is how to put it on. Because if you put it wrongly, you still don't solve any problem. And then apart from information, knowledge, and skill, then you come to the question of values. You should have values that say, I want to protect my fellow human being because I'm infected. Yes. I don't want to pass on this virus. So I'll wear a mask and tell people, keep your distance because I'm infected or I am going to get medication. I have the symptoms. Therefore, please retain your distance. And then also that you have those values that you care for yourself and you care for others. And then at a higher level is attitude. Mm. So that you have affected people's attitude. And in us, we say the sum total of this is what we call civic education and civic engagement.
Yes.
But you see, you need time, but you also need to think carefully how you are going to get this for society to accept.
Yes.
So the second point I wanted to make is that the security approach is counterproductive. It's counterproductive, one, because of the limitations of security resources. Two, it will always lead to violence and abuse of human rights. But three, it may lead to great societal upheaval. Because if you confine people in their houses or in their homes and they have no way of surviving, and if they have to choose between starvation and death at home or looking for means to survive outside, history shows us people will go outside.
Mm.
Not maybe all the people, but some people. And then after that, a momentum builds and more people come out. But also related to this is that security forces are also human beings.
Yes.
They also have families. And they also get tired. And the longer this pandemic goes on, and the longer the measures that they have, then you have a serious problem in terms of saying, how are they able to cope themselves? And God forbid, if then you have infections among the security forces and their organization patterns require them to be in proximity, close proximity. In other words, in you put them in lorries and travel them in lorries without any protective gear. And then they do drills. They report to a police station in a confined space to receive morning briefs and guidelines. You shudder if there was an outbreak among security forces.
Yes.
Their organizational patterns are such that they are not able to have distance of any type, social physical distance. So you see that what are the limitations of this security approach? First, it is wrong because it sees people as purposes to retain and protect the state. Absolutely not. It is the opposite. The state is there to serve the people, and the people are there to make decisions for themselves. So I advocate, obviously, from the way I'm talking, for a human rights approach to this response.
Thanks, Zane. Number one, I'll be keen to hear what your analysis is of these discussions that we have had about Kenya's rather unique position as a regional continental hub for commerce and trade. And this is not only in the region, but it's a position that the East African port cities also have occupied for many centuries. This has implications when you are talking about the kind of disruption that is underway, where, a colleague described to me the other day, we have essentially taken the enemy, the economy, sorry, and thrown it at coronavirus. So we have shut down. We have shut down. We're shutting down demand and supply. So an economic recession is underway. So I wanted to ask about this. What are the implications of this, of special status of these hubs, Singapore, ni kama hivyo, Kenya, ni kama hivyo. Then secondly, what are the risks involved in the kind of securitized response that we are seeing playing out in many countries, particularly those countries with poor countries like ours with densely populated cities?
Okay, let's start with Kenya being a hub, and if you analyze all countries that are hub in various places in the world in terms of commerce, in terms of travel, in terms of entertainment and leisure, including tourism, in terms of being headquarters of commerce. One of the features of these countries, they tend to be open societies. You cannot be a closed society and attract people from outside to come and do commerce or to become a financial sector hub or a regional trade hub.
Yes.
You have to open your skies, you have to open your borders, and you have to offer services. Mm. Now, one of the missteps we got as a country, we were torn between remaining open, which is a major feature of a hub, and controlling a corona pandemic. And because we took longer to close, we invited infections. So all our initial infections were imported from other countries. We took too long to close our borders. We took too long to close our airspace. Long after many countries, including China, which was the epicenter of this virus, had shut their airspace, had shut air travel, we were still receiving aircrafts. And because of the security approach, the person who blew the whistle and say, although the government is saying we are not receiving any more planes, here is the evidence that I recorded that a flight from China came and was allowed into the country. Instead of asking, why would we, after saying that the government has taken a position that we have closed our airspace, why was there a plane allowed to land in JKIA? The security approach said, arrest the person who filmed the incident.
Yes.
And then, up to date, the government has not fully explained why that was so. So in terms of security approaches, is saying, oh, we can continue to do business, but we can enhance it by enhanced security status. The second point is that as we speak now, the Mombasa port is still open. So the Mombasa port is still open and there are ships coming and ships going. There are some measures that have been adopted, but those measures are not adequate.
Okay.
They are not adequate, for example, if you compare our approach with that of Singapore. Singapore, for instance, are able to track via satellite movement of the ships approaching their shores.
Yes.
They know where these ships have been.
Yes.
They know how long they have been at sea. And Singapore does not allow any ship into its shores that has not been on the seas for more than 14 days. In other words, they only allow ships that have a longer period than the gestation period of the virus.
Yeah.
So their cutoff day is 16 days. So if they have been monitoring your ship by satellite, that it has been in the seas for more than 60 days, then you are allowed into the seashore.
Yes.
And when you are allowed into the seashore, there are procedures of declaration before you enter their waters. You declare in an enhanced, manifest, enhanced return form that indicates how many crew you have, what nationality they are, which other ports had they visited before, for how long have they been sick. In other words, they have taken absolutely critical care to ensure that they have a lot of information, apart from them monitoring by satellite, but they have a lot of information about your crew, about where they're coming from, about their health status. Have anybody fallen sick? Do they have temperature or headache, or they have all those symptoms? Does anyone have a pre-existing condition? And so on and so forth. And then they send their medical teams to those ships to evaluate if the ship is safe. And then is when only they send a team to bring the ship in the port in a restricted area with restricted protocols, including protective gear for their workers in those ship dockyards. So in other words, if you compare, for example, us and Singapore, Singapore has decided to allow for limited continuation of their status as a hub, but they have taken very careful safeguards.
Yes.
Now, our problem is that we have some safeguards. They are not very different from the safeguards that have been put for other sectors.
Yes.
And they are not specific to the requirements of keeping the port open.
Yes.
And as we speak now, some people have already been basically been infected. So what am I saying? I'm saying that the very nature of an open society that depends on global trade as a backbone, then you have to take proper planning and a proper conceptualization of this approach. Thirdly, is that countries such as ours, who depend on becoming a trade hub, are then hit much more than others. Because as a hub, we depend on being a financial hub that financing will go on. Now, that can go on. You need to turn around your focus of financing to response to the virus.
Yes.
But we have just shut down, shut down the market, the stock market, shut down the planes, shut down exports, shut down imports. So we are affected and we lose a lot of jobs because of that.
Yeah.
But we are also dependent on a lot of imports for food, for essential products, including medicines. It is only now we are making our own face masks. In other words, we have to repurpose our industrial base, which in many cases is based on, yes, the local market, but also the export market. And we are then now caught. Suddenly you lose all your revenue for tourism. Now, for a city like Mombasa and connecting cities that are dependent on the port services and port and trade,
yes,
already they were reeling and the economy was very bad. And now you take away the other major source of income, which is tourism, then the majority of the people are left helpless. What am I saying? I'm saying that if you look globally on the patterns of employment, of economic activity, if the coronavirus goes on for another 2 months, and it will, its effects are going to be long-term. I'm sorry to say this, but sometimes we have to be realistic.
Yes.
So when you're saying this, more than 80% of our people will not have any income. You know, when people are discussing this, they say, oh, you know, Jua Kali and those who are dependent on daily earnings. No, the so-called middle class in Kenya has just joined that group. Majority of companies are not paying any salaries. And the government has not, like other countries, and said, yes, we have then a framework of protection that will allow you to still earn either full or a percentage of your salary for the next 6 or 12 months. It's not that. And what does this mean? It means we don't, our situation is further complicated because we do not have a safety net. And I'm not the first one to talk about this. There are more people who are more eloquent who have talked about this. So I'm just giving you the patterns. So now let me come to the second question in terms of risks.
Mm.
If you say you close your borders, right? No African country, okay? No African country has effective control over its borders.
Yes.
You know, it's not to say except this, or no African country has effective control of its borders.
That is true.
So if you talk about countries that have more effective control than others, not complete. Say you talk about Egypt, the Sinai Peninsula is still porous. The border with Libya is still porous. Yeah. If you talk about South Africa, people from Zimbabwe still find ways of getting into South Africa, and South Africans finding their way into Zimbabwe and other countries. So the premise of the security approach is that you have effective control of your borders. We don't.
Yes.
Our border between Kenya and Ethiopia are porous.
Yes.
Kenya and Tanzania are porous.
Yes.
And so on. And to demonstrate this, we could not even effectively patrol the borders between Nairobi and the surrounding counties.
Yes.
And people had video clips of people using panya routes in Nairobi,
yes,
to get into other counties.
Yes.
So the question of openness and the lack of control go hand in hand.
Yes.
And that undermines your approach. If your approach is based on total lockdown, again, lockdown is not a technical term. Then they say total lockdown, that people cannot move. And the more you think about this, the more you then question the logic of the response. What philosophy or values or imperatives inform this approach? Maybe I can say in the last point.
Yes.
And this last point is that we have documented cases.
Yes.
Of foreigners who have found their way into Kenya.
Yes.
From other countries, particularly in Europe, and they have found that they might be better place to survive when they are in Kenya than in those places. And that we then need to deal with the question of saying, yes, we are seeking to protect our people, but we also are moved by the human circumstances of individuals or groups of people.
Yes.
John, have you had any discussions about refugees in this whole debate in Kenya?
No.
We have not had any discussions about refugees. We know that we have some of the largest refugee camps in the world, and we have one of the largest refugee population. Before the problems in Syria and Iraq and other places, we used to have the largest number of refugees. How come our response does not talk about refugees? What about undocumented persons? And when you talk about undocumented persons, Kenyans' first response is always, the foreigners, we can do with what we want with foreigners. But we have very many Kenyans who are undocumented.
That is true.
All the people who live in the streets, if Kenyans call them, I don't, but Kenyans call them street yes. families or street people.
Yes.
Many of them don't have documentation. If you go to Nairobi and Kibra, many Nubians don't have IDs. So if you make your security approach and the idea that you need to verify who is a Kenyan and who is not a Kenyan, we should say we are going to our response is going to give dignity, support, and wellness to all the people who are found in our borders. So because in the beginning we found advantage by opening our borders and becoming economically strong, by becoming a hub, then now we should not desert those who took up that idea and came and joined us. By poor planning, we then outlawed air traffic.
Yes.
And the last ones that came in, we also detained those who were on transit.
Yes.
So there are other citizens of other parts of the world, including members of the East African community, some Ugandans, some Tanzanians, some Rwandans, who are stuck in Kenya. They were on transit, and we had quickly said, no, we are not allowing any more transfer.
Yes.
And now these people are taken to quarantine. Yeah.
Yeah.
And after quarantine, where do you take them?
You know, Zain, as you said, this is a new normal. This coronavirus, we're all in lockdown now. What is happening is not something that is going to end in a month. This is not like some extended holiday that we are on. This is a pandemic that is changing our societies economically, politically, and socially in very fundamental ways. Let's touch on issues of trauma, individual and collective trauma, because we have seen at a very basic level of police attacking innocent wananchi under the auspices of enforcing the curfew. But around the world, we hear that cases of spousal abuse have skyrocketed in some cities up to 5 times. Divorce rates have gone up. So this is a very traumatic time for the world. But I'd like you to speak to that. A subsidiary question, which is something that, and you are the first person who I heard making this distinction, that there is a difference between physical distancing and social distancing. So I wanted to just put those two questions to you. One about trauma, its effects and how it can be managed and taken care of. And secondly, this distinction that you make between physical and social distancing. Because these words are currently being used interchangeably, even by policymakers.
I think the let's start with the last one because it also has an effect on trauma. So let's start with the distancing, social distancing and physical distancing. Now, some people use these words interchangeably. Some people say, let's use physical distancing because it is impossible to have social distancing and it will affect relations. But I say that we must use both words and they are related. Let's start with the physical distancing. This is a simpler one. The physical distancing is one where you limit the interaction of people or proximity between individuals to a given distance. We started by 1 meter, then we went 1.5, and I think now people are saying 2 meters.
2 meters.
So you say if you go to the supermarket in the queue, you need to have 2 meters between the person ahead of you and the person behind you. They have 2 meters. In other words, you are now respecting physical distancing. You don't know each other, therefore you're not interacting at a social level, but you are maintaining a distance between the two of you in terms of meters. The social distancing has to do much more with social patterns of behavior. When people who share relations interact. Now, for some societies, both the social, the physical distancing and the social distancing is not very difficult to do because they have created a very individualized and personalized lives.
Yes.
And to them, it's quite normal. For Africans and other communities like in Asia,
yes,
the family is still important.
Yes.
And the family is an extended family. We don't talk about, we don't draw a distinction between the nuclear family and the extended family. When people talk in Africa or in Asia or in Latin America, when they talk about family, they mean the extended family. So when they tell us that you have to create distance at a social level, that your uncle cannot visit you regularly, or your aunt. In fact, you know, other societies, before your uncle, aunt, or your father or your mother comes to your house or home, they call and make an appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And an appointment, then there's a lot of problems. And people would be asking, why didn't you tell us you're coming? We are not prepared for you. We have not made any arrangements. But in Africa, you never ask that. You could never ask that. The doorbell rings and you open and it is your mother or your aunt or your uncle. And you are hugging and embracing each other and inviting each other. They are kissing the baby and holding them and talking to each other and you're serving tea. So at a social level, it's very difficult to maintain this social distancing, as it were. And also, for both of those elements, what this pandemic has also done has demonstrated to many Kenyans, not just those who are working in the human rights or justice sectors, the inequality of our systems. So in any Kenyan city, which is part of a colonial pattern, there are quotas designated for different types of people. In colonial Kenya, it used to be the color of one's skin, and then if you support the government or you are anti-government. In other words, it's an apartheid system based on somebody's color or ethnic identity. But what we have done is to change that slightly, and now it's much more between rich and poor.
Correct.
So if you are rich and you live in a rich neighborhood, you tend to have a lot of space, You may even, you're only two people and you live in a three or four bedroom house. And you also have a garden. And you also have a guest house. And you also have a swimming pool. And you also, you have a lot of space. In other words, you also have quarters for those who serve you. But for the majority of the people in Kenya, they live in very inhumane conditions and occupy very small spaces. So when you talk about that and you say there's a family of four people who live in a one-bedroom house and the kids use the sitting room and the parents use the bedroom, and then you tell them to have social distancing or physical distancing, it becomes very difficult. And then the same family of four, and in many cases they are eight, the same family of four share a common toilet outside and a common shower.
Yes.
That involves another 10 to 20 families, which has also four people.
Yes.
So when you ask and you say to the majority of Kenyans that we want you to stay so many meters away from you, each other, social distance, your policy is not informed by the reality on the ground.
No.
It is a policy that you have adopted from others.
Yes.
If in Europe you have a family of one person who lives with their cat or with their dog, and then you say, you tell this person, maintain social distance, and they are used to calling each other and make appointments before they meet. It's not very difficult. Just say, we don't call each other. And you remain with your dog inside the house.
Yes.
Right? Cutting and pasting and copying other people's approaches to your very different circumstance and context may be good to please donors and to show yourself that you are working. But it is also proving that you're not thinking. And that's another critique against the security approach. You reduce your level of thinking. So let me go to the next one. I think I've done enough, unless you want me to clarify something about physical distancing and social distancing.
No, please go ahead.
I can only add two things. Hmm. The longer this pandemic takes, the more complicated will be our social relations in the future. Because if you are interfering with social relations now, they will have consequences.
Yes.
Okay? If you tell a grandmother, you have explained that we don't want the grandchildren to hug you because they may infect you. They may compromise your health because of your age. And the trauma you have created in that grandmother of they are denying me even to associate with my grandchildren will still remain. The second component of it will be to understand these things that are going on and to start processing them and to explain them to each other. They will reduce the possible trauma. And that's why I'm going into now trauma. Any upheaval in social conditioning has the potential of radically affecting people psychologically and mentally, and has the possibility of creating trauma at an individual level, at a family level, at a group level, and at a national level.
Mm.
And Kenyans were not very good at dealing with trauma. If you look at past traumatic experiences in our history, we have not been able to address that question of trauma very well.
Uh-huh.
Partly it's because of the way our social makeup is. Our society is very patriarchal, and men are supposed to be tough. Men are supposed to be strong. And you tell your children, men are not supposed to cry. So they can't even find relief in physiological processes.
Mm.
So if you look at one of the biggest traumatic experience we had was colonialism. And instead of dealing with the effects of colonialism and the trauma it created at the national level, at community level, at group level, we just said, let's forget. We chose to suppress memory.
Yes.
That in itself created other traumas. So for example, if you take many Kenyans who are in detention camps, who are under curfew, who were taken through very traumatic experiences, including gross violation of human rights, including torture, including collective punishment, including collective gender-based violence, including murder, including starvation, denial of a basic necessity for survival. You know, if you talk to those families, until today, it is still haunting them. They're still having nightmares.
Yeah.
Okay. And in the world these days, people talk about post-traumatic stress. In other words, the reflection of this trauma in physical attributes, in physiological attributes, in cultural attributes, in social attributes, and how to manage anger, how to manage pain, how to manage the consequences of what you saw. It affects your sleep. It affects your appetite. It affects your reasoning. It affects your relations. And as we spoke, the reported rise of physical violence at the home against women, against children, and in some cases against men, is partly explained by one, that these things were still there in society. But because we were not confined in small places for long periods of time, people manifested this at night or during weekends or when they come home angry. But now, the physical proximity of dealing with each other and people who don't know how to deal with their emotions, they resort to violence. We will have to prepare ourselves. And by now, if you listen to the Kenya Medical Practitioners Association's advisory, is that by now, our response needed to also have taken into account this many levels of trauma, and I've started sharing with people coping mechanisms, and I've started telling people, explaining to people what is happening to them in confined spaces, neighbors rising up against neighbors, the trauma that somebody who has no job and still is expected to pay rent goes through, and the potential violence between the landlord in courts, because I don't like to use that word, and tenant. To date, the government has not said suspend rent collection. To date, the government has not said ban evictions. I've seen people being evicted from their places of trade, from their homes. So you're adding trauma on trauma on trauma. So we will suffer a great deal if we don't have present measures to deal with what's going on and alleviate traumatic experiences and building into people's coping mechanisms and helping them to maintain mental health at individual and family levels. But after the pandemic and the strain, the economic and other strains, we will then suffer a great deal if we don't start preparing for effective interventions. Let me say 2 points that are important in this discussion, then we can move on to another matter possibly. One is, you raise the question of the police response. First of all, some of us who work in the human rights sector have drawn a distinction between that this security approach that they are taking creates a default position to the command and control structures in kind of what kind of instructions they give the men and women on the ground who are security forces. Secondly, those security forces have only been trained in a certain way to implement curfews, to implement lockdowns, and to deal with people in courts who are seen to be enemies of the state or disobeying, or demonstrating disobedience or refusing to follow given instructions. They act in only a certain way. That is the reason why, for instance, and it's very unfortunate, that when Kenyans are being trained to serve in peace missions, the battalions that we send to peace missions are specially trained on international humanitarian law.
That's right.
They are specially trained not to use security approaches in humanitarian situation, and they are specially trained to respect people's human rights. And they are also specially trained to defuse explosive or crisis situation using calm and humanitarian approaches. In other words, they are trained to deal with a peacekeeping mission in a humanitarian way. By now, we should have been training all our soldiers in that way, and that's the way they should be dealing with citizens.
Yes.
So what am I saying? When the curfew was declared, and they were given the instructions to enforce the curfew, we saw great violence and violations of Kenyans' rights. They started implementing the curfew even before the time. So the infamous case of the Likoni ferry violence by the police against almost 10,000 people. They unleashed violence and threw tear gas and started shooting and clobbering people, more than 10,000 people. Was partly informed by their training, partly informed by their mentality, and partly informed by their guidelines and instructions they received. Why am I saying this? Because then this pattern was repeated across the country. Yeah, you couldn't say it is a one-off.
Correct.
This is
Correct.
A systemic problem. They had the same approach of violence to all people, all places. The only difference in terms of Likoni is because there was a high concentration of people. There were more than 10,000 people congregated in one place. But we saw images of them taking out a doctor from a car, a doctor, and ask him, why are you outside during curfew time? And he brought out his ID. He showed them his pass in the car as a doctor. And he said that I provide essential services. Ah, they said, kumbe wewe ni daktari. And then they said, okay, get back into your car. But they could not resist giving him a few lashes. All right? When he was going back into his car, then they whipped him and they said, don't do it again. How will I not do it again? I'm in the front line of giving response to this pandemic. I'm in treating people. I'm gazetted as providing essential services. So it is a mentality. Yeah? It's a mentality. So again, so there was a lot of trauma of Kenyans who were violently attacked. But guess what, my brother? The attacker also goes through trauma.
Yes.
He's a human being. And every time he unleashes violence against a human being, part of him hurts. Part of him dies. Part of him is traumatized. So he has to deal with that. And the continued use of a security approach will not only create trauma among people, it will create trauma among security forces as well.
Yeah.
They have to deal with why they kicked the woman who was pregnant in the stomach and she lost her baby. This happened. They'll have to deal with why they broke somebody's legs for no good reason, that's because he was outside. They'll have to deal with the question of how they beat an old lady who was 65 years old until she lost consciousness and she lost. She broke her jaw and lost four of her teeth. And the son was being recorded saying, "I was trying to pull my mother, take her to safety. She had passed out. I couldn't carry her. I had to find help. And the lady came and we dragged my mother on the floor until we took her to safety." And she had to remain with that pain overnight before they could take her to hospital because, again, of curfew. So this traumatic experience is going to haunt us at a very high level. And then let me tell you something. Lastly, I said the last point. We have to deal with also trauma of those who are infected. And the stigma it raises among those who are infected. And the stigma it raises among the families of those who are infected. One of the reasons why Kenya is reluctant to openly say I was infected is because we know how we have treated people who have suffered from diseases in the past. Those who suffer from HIV/AIDS,
yeah,
one of the biggest medical problems they have to deal with is trauma caused by stigma. Yeah, so all those things are at play, my brother. I don't know if I've answered your question.
You have, Zain. I have one final just closing question that I would like to ask you. What has the coronavirus COVID-19 told us about us?
You know, it has told us many things. And my way of answering this is to challenge Kenyans to say, go back to your constitution and look at the values that are contained in your constitution. Those values are there for a purpose. They are there because we didn't have them. As a society, we didn't have enough of those values. So go and read Article 10, the second part B, and see what values are contained there. Go and look at the chapter on human rights and see what is missing there. So let me start by giving you examples. The first one is that because we came from a very oppressive society, because we came from a very discriminatory society, because we came from a society based on a few people oppressing majority of the people, we put Article 1 of our constitution and said, the people are sovereign. The people are sovereign, and they exercise their sovereignty either directly, like now, or through their democratically elected representatives. Now, given that their democratically elected representatives have gone missing at the most critical time in their lives, then Kenyans will have to only exercise the first part, which is direct sovereignty.
Yes.
This sovereignty is also based on articulating other principles, for example, participation. If we want to survive this pandemic and we want to limit the negative effects of this pandemic, we have no choice but to make our responsive participatory, involve everyone, involve religious leaders, involve civil society, involve non-state actors, involves workers. You must involve the whole society. Our response must be comprehensive, must be integrated, and must be participatory. Short of that, we are going to get into very serious problems. What is the cornerstone of our values in the Bill of Rights? One is the right to life. Life is precious. We have protected life in our constitution, and we said the right to life is guaranteed. In fact, when people tell you that, oh, the government can limit rights, that is not right. It's not true. The whole constitution says so. That they are certain, they can't limit rights without a proper purpose and reason. Second, proposals for limitations of rights must be constitutional and legal. Thirdly, they must be only for a specified period of time. Fourthly, that they must take a form that is less intrusive, and that they must demonstrate that you could not attain the same measures using less restrictive measures. But also, there are certain rights that cannot be taken away under any circumstance. For example, right to life. For example, the right to have due process of the law. For example, they cannot turn us into slaves, forced labor and slavery. And for example, that they cannot suspend habeas corpus rules. In other words, if you can still access the court and ask for somebody to be produced before court. So what am I saying? The right to life is primary. It's all other rights, like right to security, starts from the right to life.
Yes.
Then connected to this is dignity. So what have we learned? We have learned that we still have very oppressive structures that favors a minority and put in disfavor the majority of our people, gives certain products and services to a certain select few, and leave the majority of the people without adequate safety net services and products. Why, John, can I ask you a question? I know this can be controversial, but let me ask you, why do we have still a distinction between public and private hospitals? In a pandemic, in a situation where there's dire need by those who can afford private and dire need by those who need to go to the public, yeah. We are still saying we are a divided society, that those who are able and willing to pay will get better services than those who are not. And it's not based on need. It's not based on need. So if we must put drastic measures to survive, why don't we put drastic measures that are in favor of the people,
yes,
in favor of the majority of us? I would suggest that we should by now draw a line and say all hospitals are now public hospitals, and anybody can go and find and get service from those hospitals. You know what is stopping that? Because some of the policymakers, I suspect, are dependent on the private hospitals. And they will not want to put themselves in a situation where they have to now mingle with the majority of the people for service in public hospitals. And the avenue that they would have preferred, that is foreign treatment, is no longer available. Yeah? So let me finish by saying that there are five critical things, because there are two more in terms of scenarios of where we are going. The first three things are, one, if we are able to use a more justice, restorative justice, where we deal with dignity, where we deal with healing, where we deal with reconciliation, where we deal with treatment, where we deal with sharing, and values associated with that, will come out better at the other end. The second one is that what we do now is going to affect us in the future. And these people forget this. They think that what we do now will not affect us in the future. And they think that some of these people think they can turn back the clock. And then the third one is that involving the people, consulting with others, using the best talent and the best brains that we have in an age where you have already demonstrated in the past that you are incompetent. It is not shameful to ask for help. It's not shameful to seek those who have the best brains in your country, to ask for those who are outside government and have the best ideas for help, because you will also be helping yourself. The only problem is, in Kenya, history has shown us they only ask for help when they are at the tipping point on and the cliff facing now the fall, that's when they say, now can we ask for help? I'm saying, no, we can do that now. But the last two things have to do something to do with the future. There are two possible futures for Kenya that is awaiting us. A Kenya where some people, particularly the leadership, would not have learned anything. That we will think that we can pick up and continue with bad governance, with corruption, with human rights violations, with greed, and even the restoring and the reconstruction process, they would see that as a chance to create tenders for themselves. They'd want to continue as if nothing had happened. That is not going to work, I'm sorry. They are going to try and retain the excessive powers they are giving themselves, the undemocratic measures they are taking, and they are going to try and retain them. That is not going to work. I am not sure it will even work short run. But secondly, we can decide that now we are learning from our past mistakes. We take the opportunity to faithfully and with fidelity implement our constitution. Seek to increase measures that are drastic, but designed to make all of us survive. Not some of us, but all of us survive. Let me finish, John, by saying this. And you can edit this last part if you like.
Yeah.
We are seeing complications arising across the world. In Ecuador now, they are not even able to deal with dead bodies in the streets.
Yes.
If this pandemic continues for next 3-4 months, you'll start seeing some bad governments falling. Like the Ecuador government is very close to falling now. And that's not what we wish in terms of maintaining peace, security, law and order, but also, more importantly, maintaining the dignity of the people and the survival of the people. We should not shy away from saying things are going to get worse before they get better. And I pray and I hope all of us will stay safe and survive this pandemic. God bless all of us.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Zain. Profound and insightful as always.